Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 61, Discovering Positive Psychology, November 20th, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Marty Seligman was the president of the American Psychological Association. He pointed out that psychology was good at identifying and curing, or at least treating, psychopathology, and it focused on that for quite a long time, but that psychology was not as good at identifying and cultivating mental strengths. So he proposed the founding of a new branch of psychology that would focus on just that. And in the intervening, 8 years now, there's been a burgeoning of interest across the United States and around the world among academic psychologists, researchers, undertaking the study of the positive side of life, or what can go well with people.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. James Powelski. He's currently the director at the University of Pennsylvania's Positive Psychology Center, which supports the university's newest master's program, the Master of Applied Positive Psychology. Before going to Philadelphia to teach at Penn, Dr. Powelski served as an assistant professor of human and organizational development and religious studies at Vanderbilt University. He has a PhD in philosophy from Penn State University and a Bachelor of Science in mathematics. Dr. Powelski's main interests lie in the application of positive psychology in academic, professional, and personal settings. For the past 5 years or so, positive psychology has been the next big thing in psychology. So let's get right into the interview. Dr. James Powelski, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David. It's good to be here.
Okay. You're director of the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, I guess education director of the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and you're also involved in setting up a master's program in applied positive psychology. But before we get into talking about those programs, let's back up and have you tell our audience what positive psychology is, its history, and everything you want to tell us about positive psychology.
Sure, David. In 3 hours or less, right?
Right.
Positive psychology was launched as a field of psychology in 1998 when Marty Seligman was the president of the American Psychological Association. And in his address to the APA that year, he pointed out that positive psychology, well, he claimed that psychology was half-baked. And he pointed out that psychology was good at identifying and curing, or at least treating, psychopathology, and it focused on that for quite a long time, but that psychology was not as good at identifying and cultivating mental strengths.
Mm-hmm.
So he proposed the founding of a new branch of psychology that would focus on just that. And in the intervening, 8 years now, there's been a burgeoning of interest across the United States and around the world among academic psychologists, researchers, undertaking the study of the positive side of life, or what can go well with people. This includes studies in subjective well-being, positive emotions, savoring, those kinds of things, what Seligman refers to as the pleasant life. It also includes study on the strengths, Marty and other positive psychologists took a look at the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which, of course, put out by the American Psychiatric Association, lists hundreds of psychopathologies. I tell my students that if you're ever feeling too good someday, just too high of a mood.
Yeah, right.
You can look through that book. It'll definitely moderate your mood. It's a very helpful diagnostic manual, obviously, but positive psychologists look in there and say, well, where's the good news? Where are the strengths? And so in 2004, Christopher Peterson at the University of Michigan and Martin Seligman co-authored a book, Character Strengths and Virtues, a Handbook and Classification, which goes through, they sometimes refer to it as the UnDSM, or the Manual of the Sanities.
Okay,
so the
that's cute. I like that.
Side. And we can certainly talk more about that in our time together, David, just to give a broad overview at this point. Also then in that domain, we could talk about flow. Mike Csikszentmihalyi studies on optimal human experience and so forth. So that, what Marty refers to that category of things as the engaged life. And then finally, the meaningful life. So things, positive institutions, things like marriage and justice, democracy, and also more bricks and mortar types of things, institutions such as schools and government and businesses. So how can we make, how can we help to foster healthy institutions? So that the research has grown now. Hundreds of researchers around the world identify themselves in some way or another with positive psychology. And a few years ago, say about 3 or 4 years ago, Marty Seligman began to think about the dissemination of this research. This
Yes.
new knowledge is being created. How can we get it into the hands of people who would be likely to be able to apply it effectively? And there were a couple of ventures that he was involved in, and one of them is the Master of Applied Positive Psychology program here at the University of Pennsylvania, which is a professional degree program. Again, we can talk about this more, but we just finished up our first year, graduated our first class just a few months ago.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that it had already been around for a year.
No, it started in 1995, and it's the first degree program anywhere at this point in positive psychology. There are now other programs that are starting up. I think the earliest one that I know of will begin in February of 2007. So there are others in other countries that are starting up, but to this point, it's the only one.
In other countries, okay.
Correct.
Yeah, now I will want to come back to this. There's so many areas that I would really like to touch on here. And by the way, I've used his book, Authentic Happiness, as well as Csikszentmihalyi's book on flow.
Yes.
I used both of those books in a course I taught up until fairly recently called Human Potential.
Excellent.
And so I'm familiar with both of those, although my listeners may not be. Now, one of the ways that Marty got this all kicked off was, I recall the announcement of a prize of $100,000 by the Templeton
Yes.
Association for the most outstanding piece of research in positive psychology that year.
That's right, by someone under 40 years of age.
Yeah, and has that continued each year, or was that a one-time
No,
deal?
It was a three-year deal, as I understand. And so Barb Fredrickson won it the first year. It was offered in, would that have been 2000, 2001, something like that.
It's really hard to believe that it's been 8 years, because I was at that APA.
Is that right?
Yeah,
wow.
When Marty made that announcement.
In San Francisco? Excellent.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that has distinguished positive psychology from some of the things that came before was a real emphasis on the importance of establishing its base in empirical research.
That's right, David.
And I'm wondering if you can, you know, and it may be hard off the top of your head, but can you describe some of the key research that this approach has generated? For example,
Sure.
Go ahead.
Sure. So, first of all, I should say that obviously, what does Chris Peterson like to say? Something like positive psychology is a recent field with a long history. So there certainly were precursors to positive psychology in a number of domains, including philosophy. Back, if you think back to Athens and Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and then those following in the Greco-Roman world were very much interested with human flourishing. What is the good life, eudaimonia, and so on. So it's not as though positive psychologists 8 years ago invented thinking about the positive things. And there are more recent precursors as well in psychology. We can think about humanistic psychology, obviously, things like health psychology, community psychology, and so forth.
Well, I am so glad to hear you say that, because
I was prepared to take you to task on that point. Because I've been highly identified with humanistic psychology.
Yes.
And while fortunately I'm broad enough of spirit and attitude to say, okay, I'm going to teach from his book, I actually celebrate the fact that positive psychology has come along and given a kind of rebirth to those of us who really believed that there needed to be a positive psychology all along.
Right.
And who have labored, you know, I have labored in this vineyard for 35 years. And I had the feeling that Marty didn't give sufficient acknowledgement to that work.
David, I think that's right, and I think it's unfortunate. My guess is that, you know, when you're trying to launch something, you may go overboard in trying to show how this is different from, you know, maybe sort of Freud's killing the father kind of thing or something.
Yeah, right.
So you need to distinguish, hey, this is something new, it's something exciting, and I think maybe Marty went a little overboard on that, and I think he's now moderated, and certainly other positive psychologists want to acknowledge very strongly. I don't know if you've seen Chris Peterson's new book, A Primer in Positive Psychology.
No, I haven't.
That's a great book. Just came out a couple of months ago. I think it was in August of this year, and it's a wonderful resource, easy to read, fun to read, but really a key research resource for positive psychology. So I would highly recommend it, and he certainly acknowledges the debt that positive psychology owes to a number of precursors.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that. And
yeah.
I understood that probably there was this desire to, you know, to get the visibility, the drama of staking out a new field.
That's right.
And also, I know that Marty felt that humanistic, transpersonal, existential approaches to psychology had not been sufficiently grounded in research and empiricism.
Right.
I'm prepared to argue that a little bit, not to turn it into a huge deal.
No. And it depends on what one means by research, clearly.
Yes.
And so there, research is, you know, takes a lot of different forms. And when you think about Maslow's characteristics of the, you know, his hierarchy and
the self-actualizing personality.
Exactly. And there were 15 of those principles, which is actually really interesting to look at those and compare them to the strengths and virtues that Peterson and Seligman identified. But the way he went about that, as I understand it, you know more about this than I do, David, but he sort of looked around and nominated, you know, who would be somebody that I would imagine might be self-actualized, and then looked more carefully into their lives. What kinds of characteristics do they have? And then from there went at a second iteration of that, okay, then who among this first list actually has these characteristics in spades? And then how can I identify then a smaller group of people, and then what are their characteristics? So it's an interesting kind of methodology, which is different from what Peterson and Seligman and others went through to create the virtues and the classification of strengths and virtues, where they sort of did a literature review, or maybe it's more accurate to call it a cultural review, looking back at, you know, ancient Athens, the ancient Far East, the Christian literature, contemporary things, to try to look, to try to find lists of strengths and virtues, to see if there was a core of them that kept coming up. And their argument is that there is such a core, and they've tried to suggest what at least some of those elements are. So, and then that has generated a lot of empirical research, and I'm answering or trying to shed a little bit of light on the question you asked initially about positive psychology research. So now with these 24 strengths that positive psychologists have identified, they have developed a questionnaire, a test to identify where people stand on these strengths, the idea being that some of us are, you know, better at certain strengths than others. So, for example, some of us may be better at love of learning than we are at kindness or than we are at humor. And then it's interesting to see where people rate, say, by demographic division, by nation, by age, by gender, and so on, to try to see if there are strengths that are particularly salient for particular occupations, for example, or particular age groups or nations.
And there have been findings in relation, I believe, to health, to longevity, to money, to spiritual orientation. Can you comment on some of those?
Yeah, sure. And in so doing, I want to come back a little bit to your question about the empirical piece, too. And we talked about the humanistic psychologists. I should also mention, of course, somebody like Mike Csikszentmihalyi has, you know, he was researching flow long before positive psychology came along. People like C.R. Snyder researching hope theory, or folks doing, you know, Bandura with self-efficacy, or Locke and Latham on goal setting. So there are a lot of people who
and there was research on creativity. There was research on love.
Right.
Lots of us were there were people doing research on biofeedback and self-regulation.
Uh-huh.
My own doctoral research in 1970 bore on meditation.
So, oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So, and that was at the University of Michigan, you know, where you wouldn't think sort of thing was going on. Since we're touching on this, and I don't mean to beat a dead horse, I'm really glad that you're as open to this discussion as possible. But for my listeners, I want to plant this flag in the soil here. I wanted to share with you a quote from Maslow just to underscore, you know, what you've acknowledged. And by the way, he did try to develop a questionnaire based on those traits that he identified through studying people like Einstein and Abraham Lincoln and other great people in history, and then he developed an inventory to detect the degree to which people might be self-actualizing. He gave it to a couple of classes of undergraduates, as I recall, and none of them scored high enough to qualify. And maybe it was just a developmental issue, but I think he didn't follow through on that line of research. Let me read you a quote from his 1970 book, where he said, and I think you'll see here how closely this fits with the agenda of positive psychology. He wrote, "Human life will never be understood unless its highest aspirations are taken into account. Growth, self-actualization, the striving toward health, the quest for identity and autonomy, the yearning for excellence, and other ways of phrasing the striving upward, must by now be accepted beyond question as a widespread and perhaps universal human tendency."
That's beautiful.
Yeah, isn't it?
Certainly. Yeah, yeah.
And then there were other contributors, not only Maslow, but also Carl Rogers, Gardner Murphy, Sidney Girard. And all of this group, I know your background is in philosophy. I want to get to that as well. So I'm sure you're familiar that the whole thrust of humanistic psychology grew out of existentialist philosophy with roots in Kierkegaard, Heidegger, Sartre, Camus, Desjardins, Paul Tillich, and Martin Buber. And they all emphasize the importance of taking responsibility for our lives of choice and the creation of meaning. Mm-hmm. Are those themes at all being echoed in the findings of positive psychology?
Yeah, so I can just tell you in the course that I teach courses on positive interventions in our master's program, and just during our last class meeting, we talked about humanistic psychology.
Wonderful.
And we, you know, we went over some of the Rogers stuff, some of the Maslow stuff. We didn't have a whole lot of time to go into a whole lot of detail, but we certainly pointed out, you know, similarities so I guess I like to think of positive psychology as kind of an umbrella term and maybe a term of invitation, because I think that it does provide for many folks at least a sort of an exciting new, I think a lot of young folks coming along, it resonates.
It does
with them
resonate.
In a way.
It definitely
That's
does.
Right.
Humanistic psychology as a term, you know, I must confess, has lost its cachet for whatever reason, and positive psychology really rings for people, as you point out, not only among young people, but among academics, and that's very important.
And hopefully then positive psychology can help to give new life to many of these humanistic ideas that maybe people will be drawn to through positive psychology, and perhaps there will be ways of creating more empirical approaches.
I think so.
To those studies.
Yeah, I celebrate it. I wouldn't have asked you to be on if I didn't actually celebrate it. Even while I have this critique that I've run by.
Sure. So, by the way, David, mm-hmm. let me say, I think one of the things that positive psychology is very much in need of is the growing of its. It needs to grow roots in intellectual history. So mm-hmm. part of what I'm interested in as a philosopher is the underpinnings of positive psychology. I just sent out a questionnaire to about 100 folks that I've been emailing back and forth with, either in positive psychology or philosophers, about what they understood as being the importance of philosophy for positive psychology. Certain questions, certain philosophical problems, perhaps, that would need to be addressed, like the definition of positive, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I really agree that it's important for positive psychology for philosophers and positive psychologists to try to, from either side, grow or build this bridge between the sort of empirical emphasis on subjective well-being or strengths and so on, and these deep cultural roots in some of the figures that you mentioned, in people like William James and John Dewey, going back even further into the Greek world as well.
Well, let me suggest that you also reach out to some of the contemporary people who are still alive and who have done a lot of thinking and work in this area. Reach out to some of those folks. For example, maybe people who are on the editorial boards of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology or the Journal mm-hmm. of Transpersonal Psychology. There are people who are alive and kicking who have a lot of history and perspective that hopefully there could be more dialogue and more cross-fertilization.
Yeah. I think that's great, David. I know there was a special issue in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology on positive psychology early on. It was now, 3 or 4 years ago, I think.
Okay.
That was very interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So coming back to some of the research, now I know that there have been some findings in relation to health, that if people have certain sorts of positive orientations and attitudes, that they tend to be healthier and live longer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does anything spring to mind?
Sure.
Unfortunately, I don't have his book. It's packed away since I retired, and I have these boxes of books, and I wish I had been able to lay my hand on it.
No problem. Yeah. So there again, we can think about, perhaps it's helpful to think about these different research programs like Mike Csikszentmihalyi's on flow, or mm-hmm. Ed Diener's on subjective well-being, or C.R. Snyder's on hope, or Martin Seligman's on learned optimism, as maybe pylons that are driven into the ocean floor
mm-hmm.
and create the construct of positive psychology as a movement then can build.
Yes.
So when we look at connections between positive psychology constructs and health outcomes, we might take, for example, optimism. And we might think of it either in the formulation that Seligman has given to optimism in terms of explanatory style so that if something, an event happens to you, how do you explain that event to yourself and others? Is it
Do you see the glass half full or half empty?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So is it because, did I suffer this misfortune because I'm an idiot or terrible or deserve to be punished? Or is it because I had a bad day? So there are many different ways of explaining these kinds of events. We could think of optimism more along the lines of Shire and Carver with expecting good things in the future, which, again, is very much related to the glass half full, glass half empty. Or we could think of it in terms of hope theory. Again, Snyder's view that hope is composed of goals and our pathways thinking and our agency thinking. So do we have different ways of getting to those goals, and do we have the motivation to get there? Each of these, the Seligman, the Shire and Carver, and the Snyder were all research programs going on when positive psychology was born. So mm-hmm. they predate positive psychology. But they indicate that optimism, however you define it in these three terms, optimism is linked to greater well-being, less depression, more success in school, more physical health, more success in the world, and so forth. So that's one area. We can also talk about subjective well-being. You probably have heard of a nun study
yes.
where there was a group of nuns who wrote their entry essay some 90 years ago, almost 100 years ago now, and researchers went back and did a content analysis of their essays to see which of the nuns had positive terms in there. I'm delighted to be here. I'm excited to see what this new venture will entail, etc., versus those who was more, you know, it's my duty to be here, I'm going to serve God, etc. So they divided this sample into quartiles, and when comparing the upper quartile and the lower quartile, the results were phenomenal. I'm not going to get all the numbers exactly right off the top of my head, but I believe when the cohort then was in their 90s or so, something like 54% of the happiest nuns were still alive versus 11% of the lower quartile.
Right. That's more or less my recollection as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. So that doesn't prove that if a nun had, you know, written joyful in her essay, she would have lived, you know, 10 years longer. But it makes one pause, and hopefully will lead to more, not just correlational, but causal studies.
Right. Right. And so there are impacts of, I guess, what you would call positive thinking, positive expectations, positive self-talk. It really ties in a lot with some of the cognitive behavioral theory, doesn't it? Because the importance mm-hmm. of positive self-talk, I think, is being borne out.
Certainly, certainly. And David, if you look at, you know, Marty Seligman's earlier work, of course, it's very, very cognitive, and the whole construct of learned helplessness and learned optimism, it's very, the interventions that he suggests, the disputation models that he suggests for learning optimism, mm-hmm. those
for
are very cognitive.
Challenging your negative thoughts, is that what you mean by disputation?
Yeah, that's right. So he has an ABCDE model. So you identify the adversity, you write down what beliefs you have about that, and then the consequences of those beliefs. So my wife is not home from work yet, and it's mm-hmm. now 7 o'clock. She should have been home an hour ago. So what are my beliefs? Well, my beliefs are, well, I wonder what she's doing. You know, she's staying late at work an awful lot these days. That makes me really nervous about what's going on at work. Maybe she's developing some kind of relationship there. And then what are the consequences of that? I'm agitated. I'm nervous. And, you know, I feel bad about her, bad about myself. I may become angry. And this is in my head. So when she comes home, you know, the consequences might be I yell at her. Where were you? You were an hour late. Whereas if I then go to the D and the E, the disputation is, well, now wait a minute. You know, she's late, sure, but she's told me exactly what she's been working on. I know her colleagues. You know, I trust her, et cetera. This happens once a year when they're working on this particular project. So it's, you know, settle down, relax. She'll be home soon. And then once I successfully dispute those beliefs, then I feel E, the energization, the energy that comes from, okay, I can relax, and I'm sure she'll be home.
Oh, that's interesting. The E there is seems like a particularly unique contribution. The ABC,
right.
At least, I recognize
yes.
a lot of Albert Ellis in there.
Correct,
yeah.
Correct. I think the D and the E were sort of added, I believe, by Marty, and I think it was Steve Holland was a researcher he was working with at that point.
Okay. And one of the points that Marty made in his book, Authentic Happiness, and that was also in Csikszentmihalyi's book, is citing research that shows that money, that the amount of money that one makes or has, tends not to be correlated with happiness. And most of us assume that, oh, if only I had more money, then I'd really
right.
be happy.
Right. This is a fun one. I guess I can admit that I take perverse joy in this, but this is a fun one to work with undergraduates in particular. You know, you say, well, you know, why are you here? Well, I'm here to get an education. Why does this matter? Well, I want to, you know, go out and get a job and make a lot of money and be happy. This is sort of the trajectory.
Yeah.
And then when you point out that the research indicates that if once you reach a certain threshold, so if you have enough money for, you know, food and clothes and a roof over your head, then the difference is negligible. It makes some difference, but not a whole lot, not as much as you would imagine. You're not twice as happy earning $100,000 as you are at $50,000. So it kind of helps to explain the phenomenon that in this country in the last, 50 years, our real earnings have skyrocketed, but our happiness levels have remained flat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is of particular interest to me, too, because I have an upcoming interview with a guy who's written what I can only call a get-rich-quick book.
Right.
And it seems like the underlying premise is, you know, bust through all your self-limiting thoughts and beliefs and all your previous programming so that you can become rich like me, and then you'll be happy. And it seems to me that there's a whole line of research that really kind of challenges that.
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, David, because, you know, there may be people who are happier when they make more money, and there may be people, I mean, it's just common sense that the distribution would there would be a distribution around this. So
yeah,
some people would be happier and making more money. Some people would be sadder and making more money. On average, people who are making more money aren't that much happier. So what would be interesting, I think, then, is to ask, okay, what makes people who are wealthy happy? So study the people who are wealthy and happy. Compare those to the people who are wealthy and unhappy. What are they doing differently?
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Is it that they've, you know, followed this gentleman's advice and broken through their limiting beliefs and now are happy and wealthy? I don't know, and I don't think he does either. Mm-hmm. But it certainly is a fascinating realm for further study, I think.
I think that's an interesting study there. You could hand that off to one of your doctoral students.
That's right. That's right. I joke with my students that, you know, there are some people who are made happier by increased income. There are some people who are not made happier by increased income. It just so happens that I'm one of those people who is made happier, so I should get all of the raises.
Yes.
And those who are not made happier by increased income should not get any raises.
Well, they should donate their raises to you.
That's entirely. Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you guys also cite evidence that having a spiritual orientation, not necessarily any certain spiritual orientation, but that people seem to be happier on average, to do better if they do have some kind of a spiritual rudder.
Yeah, David, I'm not as up on this literature. I do know that there has been some indication that folks who have religious commitments do seem to be happier than other people. Why is that? I don't think anyone completely knows at this point. There are various possibilities. It could be because people with religious commitments tend to have better networks of friends. So if you fall ill and you belong to a church, you may well be visited by the clergy person in charge as well as other parishioners, whereas if you don't belong to a church, you may just get visits from your family and a couple of coworkers. Is it because people who are religious tend to engage in less risky behaviors, which then in turn leads to greater happiness, is another possibility? Are there benefits from the particular rituals that religious persons engage in, maybe some kind of meditation practices and so on, which, again, from your research that you worked on, would seem to indicate there might be some relation. So I don't think we know with precision what it is about a religious affiliation that, and of course there could be, there may be some kind of supernatural reason, you know, who knows. So we don't know what it is about a divine, a religious connection that makes people happier, but it seems like there's at least a correlation there.
Okay. Now your background is in philosophy, as we've already noted. And, of course, philosophers have thought long and hard about the good life and the nature of happiness. What's the picture of happiness or the good life that's emerged out of this research? Is it possible to say at this point?
I think it's fascinating. I'll just tell you one idea that I've actually blogged about recently, and it's the question of whether positive psychology turns Aristotle on his head. So in his book on the virtues, the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle writes that happiness is the end toward which all actions aim. So again, this is a fun one to do in an undergraduate class. You ask students, you know, why are you here? Well, I'm here because there's an attendance requirement for this class. Well, why do you want to fulfill the attendance requirement? Because I want to get a good grade in the class. Why do you want to get a good grade in the class? Because I want to graduate with a good GPA. Why do you want to graduate with a good GPA? Because I want to get a good job. Why do you want to get a good job? Because I want to make a lot of money. Why do you want to make a lot of money? Because I want to be happy. Well, why do you want to be happy? I want to be happy. There's really no place to go past that. So for Aristotle, all of our actions are undertaken with the aim of happiness. Now, we may be wrong that undertaking a certain action will make us happy, but that's, he argues, that's why we engage in this particular action. Now, positive psychologists then seem to be claiming that happiness actually has consequences. That is to say, happiness isn't just an end, but it's also a means.
Mm-hmm.
So we mentioned earlier that happiness or various components of it could increase longevity, increase health, increase academic success, increase athletic success, and so on. So has positive psychology turned Aristotle on his head and claim now that happiness is good instrumentally for these other valuable things? And I guess I would want to take the question one step further then and say, okay, maybe, but why do we want those other things? So why do we want longevity, increased longevity? Why do we want better health, more success in academia and in athletics? Well, presumably because it'll make us happier, we think. So maybe it's kind of a positive loop that happens. So maybe it's not that Aristotle gets turned on his head. Maybe Aristotle is, I don't know, doing cartwheels or somersaults or something in some kind of happiness loop.
Also, I think there may be more direct routes to happiness than, you know, than the good grades, the career, et cetera. Not that I totally discount those, but I think that one can really by, you know, looking at cognitions and by making choices about cognition and affect, that we do have some range of choice there, and that it's possible to kind of go straight to happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would certainly agree. And also, it depends on, you know, grades. Does somebody, for example, undertake academic or athletic performance for extrinsic reasons or for intrinsically motivated reasons? So obviously, a lot now that ties in to the kinds of things that you were talking about. So if somebody is intrinsically motivated to learn, that's much more likely, I think, to lead to happiness than somebody who's doing it because their parents are on their case or something like that.
Yeah.
I think your point, even more directly, it doesn't necessarily have to do with athletics. That doesn't have to do with athletics and academics. Those could be domains of application, but it may be more generally how we communicate with ourselves, how we interpret events, what we expect in the future, and so on.
Yes, definitely. Well, I believe that there are two kind of applied programs that I'm aware of. One is the coaching program. Have you been involved with that at all?
I have, David, and it actually is not continuing at this point.
Oh, really?
That was the first, at least large-scale, dissemination effort that Marty Seligman undertook. Now, I believe he began it in 2003, something like that, and it went for about 2 years. And that was an online, it was over the telephone,
mm-hmm.
and if you signed up for it, you would get PowerPoint slides
mm-hmm.
for the talks, and you could follow that, and it was over the telephone. And then there were about, between 200 and 300 people on the class at a particular time. And then, once a week, there would be lectures that Marty would give or an invited guest would give. And then once a week, there would be small groups that would meet again over the telephone, but in, say, 15 to 20 or so. And I was one of the small group leaders for that.
Okay.
But then it's now, in a sense, the master's program here is kind of a continuation of that. And again, so I moved to the University of Pennsylvania in January of 2005 to start this program. And we've just launched it, as I mentioned. We launched it in the fall of 2005. So we're now into about the middle of the second class, and we're actually looking for our third class.
Is it a one-year program?
It's a one-year program. It's aimed toward professionals, so people who are successful in their fields. It could be business. It could be law. It could be education. It could be clinical psychology. It could be coaching or other fields. They already have their credentials. They want to come and immerse themselves in positive psychology for a year. It's an executive education model, so they don't need to move to Philadelphia. They can commute from virtually anywhere in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have 3 students this year commuting from Europe. And if you can believe it, 2 from Hong Kong who come in to our on-site visits. Our on-site classes happen about once a month, and then there are distance learning periods that happen in between that. So we have, most of our students are older professionals, but we also have about a third of our students are younger students, recently out of college. They don't yet have their academic, their professional credentials, but they're studying positive psychology, many of them as a stepping stone toward moving on to getting their PhDs.
Interesting. Now, what about some kind of licensing? Do you think that these people will be able to, what sort of shingle might these people
That's a really great question, very good point, and we're not in the business here in this program. You can imagine in 1 year we really couldn't do any kind of credentialing or licensing in that way.
Yes.
So what we rely on is the professional credentials that these students either already have or are intending to get. So, for example, if someone would like to, if a clinical psychologist would like to come and study, they then can practice on the strength of their PhD in clinical psychology and their licensure in that regard, not on the strength of their MAP degree. But the MAP degree is intended to be an add-on to help people in whatever profession to be able to take a different approach in their professional life.
Yeah, and the MAP refers to Master's in
Master of Applied
Psychology.
Positive Psychology. That's
right. And being trained as a clinical psychologist myself, just curious, what kind of anecdotal feedback are you hearing from people who have kind of set themselves up as practitioners of positive psychology?
Do you mean particularly within psychology, David, or do you just mean anywhere?
Well, both, I guess, because I guess there are people out there who are offering services as coaches as psychologists.
That's right. And again, our program doesn't train people to be coaches, but it allows coaches or persons who are going to be coaches to be trained as coaches to use positive psychology in powerful ways. One of our graduates is a coach who has specialized in goal-setting theory, particularly with her clients. So she's working on helping her clients maximize their goal-setting abilities and using other elements of positive psychology in that regard in her practice. And she's very successful with that. And she has an internet radio program that she's just starting as well. The person who has taught our course on positive psychology and the clinic is in private practice here in the Philadelphia area and has been incorporating positive psychology into her work. And I don't know if you're familiar at all with a new book, David, that's come out by Michael Frisch. He's at Baylor. And the title of the book is Quality of Life Therapy. And the subtitle is Applying a Life Satisfaction Approach to Positive Psychology and Cognitive Therapy. The main title is Quality of Life Therapy by Michael Frisch, F-R-I-S-C-H. And that's the textbook she in her class and found it to be really a wonderful resource.
I think she might make a great guest. Maybe you could drop me her email address.
Sure.
And I'll contact her and see if she might be interested in talking
about
the clinical applications.
Sure.
Well, I've held you longer than I indicated that I was going to, and I really appreciate your generosity with your time. I wonder
It was fun, David.
Yeah. Are there any final words for our listeners as to how they might create more happiness in their own lives?
Yeah, I guess I would say that, you know, the part of what really attracted me to positive psychology is part of similar to what attracted me to the type of philosophy that I do. You know, philosophers are famous or infamous for sitting around thinking all day and not really getting around to doing anything, which I don't think is a very good recipe for happiness. So one of the things that I find powerful about positive psychology is that it both intends, at least, to be scientific, academically rigorous, and also that it's about application. So when I'm teaching these courses in positive psychology, it's about theory, it's about research, and it's also about practice. So obviously, if you know these things but you don't actually apply them in your life, they don't really do a whole lot of good for increasing happiness. And the other thing I think that's promising about positive psychology is, can we sort, you know, the self-help industry is huge. Are there things there that are good? I certainly think so. Are there things that probably aren't so helpful? I suspect so. How can we tell the difference? It's tough to know. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, you know, positive psychology is just 8 years old, so it's still in diapers with respect to the development of a scientific field. But I hope that as it continues to develop, and that we'll be able to learn more with greater confidence about the kinds of things that, are efficient ways of moving toward greater happiness in the full sense of human flourishing and life satisfaction.
Okay, well, you guys are doing great work, and I really look forward to seeing how all of this unfolds. And,
thank you, David. I just might, could I mention the website if anybody wants to find out more about the master's program? You can find out more about that at penpositivepsych.org. So it's P-E-N-N, and then the words positivepsych.org. And that's the website on the positive psychology, the Master of Applied Positive Psychology program. If folks are interested just in finding out more about positive psychology, they can go to the center, the Positive Psychology Center's website, which is simply www.positivepsychology.org.
Terrific.
And there may be some folks who are interested in some of the measures that positive psychologists are using, David, and there are a number of those measures are available for free. I'll give one more website if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
These are available for free, including the values in action classification, the questionnaire for identifying your strengths. That's available for free at the following website, www.authentichappiness.org.
Okay, well, you've given our listeners a lot of good resources there. And Dr. James Pawelski, thanks so much for being our guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much, David. Great being with you.
I hope you found this interview instructive. Dr. Pawelski certainly strikes me as an excellent person to be heading up the new master's program at the University of Pennsylvania. I really enjoyed speaking with him and found him to be both very positive, which is important considering his position, and also very knowledgeable of the psychological literature, despite the fact that his doctoral degree is in philosophy. And of course, I was very pleased to hear him acknowledge the contributions of humanistic psychology. In his inaugural address after being elected president of the American Psychological Association, Dr. Martin Seligman announced that he was creating a new field to be called positive psychology. Many people who had been working in humanistic psychology for several decades were incensed that he seemed to give absolutely no recognition to the fact that they had long been working on a very positive approach to psychology. They had rebelled against the pathological emphasis of Freudian psychology on the one hand and against the cold, mechanistic approach of Skinnerian behaviorism on the other. The emergence of humanistic psychology was an exciting and commanding development in its time. But to some degree, that time has passed. I think there are many reasons for that passing. For one thing, the term humanistic drew fire from the Christian right, which had vehemently condemned something they called secular humanism. For another, humanistic psychology gave birth to a widespread human potential movement, which was often burlesqued in the press and elsewhere as excessively narcissistic and as giving rise to what was called the me generation. However, I think the biggest reason for the decline of humanistic psychology as a distinctive field is that the rebellion succeeded. The critique of strict Freudian and Skinnerian doctrines was largely heard and accepted. And many of the beliefs, attitudes, and techniques that grew out of humanistic psychology and the human potential movement have diffused into the culture and into education to such a degree that they no longer are distinctive. It's not new stuff. It's taken for granted. Another piece of the critique was that humanistic psychology was not generating enough empirical research to establish itself as a legitimate academic field. Enough time has gone by for me to have some perspective on all this, and I've come around to the point of view that positive psychology is perfect for this point in time. Dr. Seligman is the perfect vehicle for a renewed call to a positive orientation in psychology. He was already one of the most widely recognized and celebrated living academic psychologists in the world. His rise to president of the American Psychological Association gave him the bully pulpit from which to make a dramatic declaration and have it be credible. He was sufficiently well-connected and entrepreneurial to draw large sums of money into the field, and his prior research achievements plus his professorship at a major Ivy League school make him unassailable on academic grounds. To me, this is somewhat reminiscent of another eminent psychologist who helped make the field of hypnosis academically respectable. I'm referring to Ernest Hilgard, who was a widely celebrated learning theorist at Stanford University. His Introduction to Psychology text was for many years the standard throughout the country, as was his text on learning theory. Throughout its history, hypnosis has had many ups and downs in terms of acceptance and scientific respectability. Hilgard had a secret, long-standing interest in hypnosis, which he kept to himself until very late in his career. Once his reputation as a scholar and researcher was firmly established, he did groundbreaking work on hypnotic susceptibility and published a very influential book with that title. I bring the Hilgard story up because it demonstrates how the blessing from a respected academic source can bestow respectability on a whole field, and I'm sure there are other good examples of this. I don't know if earlier in his career Dr. Seligman was in the closet about his positivity or not. In fact, it would appear that his positivity springs from what some would consider fairly negative beginnings. Dr. Seligman's initial reputation was built developing the concept of learned helplessness. In a book by that title, he describes a long line of research in which he and others traumatized dogs by exposing them to electric shocks from which they could not escape. When the dogs were placed in an environment from which escape was possible, a certain percentage of them did not discover or make use of the escape possibility that was available to them. Thus, they had learned to be helpless, to give up, to stop trying to get away. Dr. Seligman used this basic paradigm to understand a variety of human environments, such as the welfare system, such as growing up in an abusive family, which often produce a kind of learned helplessness. He also noted, however, that a certain percentage of dogs and people exposed to these traumatic experiences would not go into the paralysis of hopelessness, but would be able to make positive adaptations once environmental conditions had changed. It's almost as if some people react to trauma by internalizing a statement along the lines of, "It's always going to turn out badly for me. There's no use trying." While other people have an internal statement along the lines of, "This is a bad situation, it will pass, or I may be able to change it." This led Dr. Seligman, in a second phase of his research career, to do a whole line of studies on optimism and the possibilities of enhancing or teaching optimism, learned optimism, if you will. It was this research in optimism that led to his epiphany that psychology should focus less on the negative and more on the positive. So I celebrate this rebirth of commitment to exploring the best in human nature and how to optimize it. Once again, I want to thank Dr. James Pawelski for sharing his thoughts with us and to Dr. Martin Seligman for putting us together.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And shrink wrap radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
I want to thank both Podshow and GoDaddy for their sponsorship, which helps to keep our operation going. Right now, you'll find valuable GoDaddy discounts on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Also, if you have a product or service and would like to be a sponsor, please drop me an email. Thanks so much to each of you who has taken our listener survey. Right now, we have 65 completed surveys, which include a lot of valuable feedback and suggestions. I'm still hoping that that number will go up to 100 or more in the next week or so. If you haven't filled it out yet, please do so. You'll find it at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And also, there's a link to it on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. For everyone who completes the survey and includes their name and email address, I'm going to send you a link to a radio talk on dreams I gave before a live audience at the University of New Hampshire. Now, I gave that talk probably 30 years ago, so if you want to hear what the young Dr. Dave sounds like, this is your chance. So if you're listening in your car or on a walk, please remember to do it first thing when you get back home. It only takes a few minutes. There are already some interesting patterns beginning to show up in the survey. One has to do with my playing a PodSafe music selection at the end of each show. I've enjoyed being a disc jockey in the process of finding songs that seem to bear somehow on the topic of a given episode. However, half of survey takers feel either neutral or somewhat negative about that feature. So, unless I hear a big outcry, I think for now I'll drop that feature and simply close the show with the brief close of our theme music. So let me know if you have any strong feelings either way about this decision. Meanwhile, our Frapper map has grown to 258 pins. Way to go, people! We have 7 new additions to our Frapper map, and I want to give a big thank you and a welcome to Mike in New Hampshire. That's Hampton, New Hampshire. Christine in Las Vegas, Nevada. Gordon in Tucker, Georgia. Ignacio in Santa Fe, Argentina. And Ignacio, you get my special thanks because you are the first person on our map, not only from Argentina, but from South America. So let me hear more from you. Please drop us a line. And if anybody else is in South America, please add yourselves to our Frapper map. And then we also have Tim in Little Rock, Arkansas, and Raj in Northwood, England, and finally Chris in Rockland, California. To add yourself to our growing Frapper map, all you have to do is go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, and also there's a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book that I co-authored.
Hi, my name is Judy from County Cork, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Judy from County Cork, Ireland, for that transition, which tells us it's time to go to some listener emails. First, we hear from John, who writes, "First of all, I've been enjoying your podcasts. I use my treadmill time to listen. I'm not a psychologist, but I must have read about 1,000 books on the subject. Wow, color me impressed." He goes on to say, "Dr. Hess is contagious and engaging. Her ability to really listen came through on the podcast. Her manner is a fine example of active listening. Is she a hypnotist?" Well, John, not that I know of, but she might be. She does. She's involved in a lot of things. And then moving along, we hear from Gita, the concert cellist, who I read from in the last episode. And she sends a follow-up email, which, among other things, says, "I downloaded that rather wonderfully extensive reading list." She's referring to the one by Suzanne Lovell, the art therapist. "And I figure that's going to keep me pretty busy for a while. She really must be such a hoot." Yes, she is. "I do so love how passionate your guests are about what they do. I particularly loved the show on the artist who had left art for a while and came back to it with such inspirational renewal. I was rather fascinated at his flexible ability to not simply become frozen in his vows, but to truly follow his own path, even when it led to such an unexpected reemergence of his art." She's referring to the show with Jerry Winstrom. I don't remember the number. She goes on to write, I also loved the interview with the chaplain who works with addictions, and I thought you did such a marvelous job of drawing out his deeply moving theological convictions as well. Actually, I think the interviewer was my Australian friend. But at any rate, she writes, I could go on, but it's late, and I'm sure I will have plenty of opportunities to be writing to you about your fascinating shows in the future. I hope you're feeling much better soon. I had written to her that I was sick, and taking very good care of that wonderful energy and exuberance which so carries across the airwaves. Take care, Gita. Thanks so much for that, Gita. Tom in London writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. Tom calling from London, England. Just a quick note to tell you how much I enjoy listening to your podcasts and to thank you for this free, invaluable resource. I am a coach/trainer/therapist working in the field of personal and professional training and development. My clients are mainly the corporate worried well, rather than the desperate and depressed, but I'm always available to help people that are in need outside of my usual working day. At this time in my career, I like to keep things positive and fun, but I try to stay aware of the many issues around human psychology, so I really appreciate the broad range of pods you post, particularly the most recent on working with victims of torture. Very inspirational and enlightening. Listening to your podcast keeps my eye on the ball and my feet on the ground. You must be building up some really good funds in your karma bank for this work. Thanks again, Tom. Well, Tom, I hope you're right about me doing some good banking with my karma. I'm sure it could use it. And I'm really glad that the show on working with victims of torture connected with you. I had some concern that the topic might be, quotes, too heavy and drive people away. We hear from another Tom who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, just a quick note on the potential risks of talk therapy. I would have been keen to hear you explore this further with a guest at some stage. I agree with your comments on the potential damage of ethical transgressions and also that people are, in general, fairly robust, and in an open, caring environment, there is little that can go bad, even if it doesn't go well. However, I believe that everyone should be aware of the potentially damaging suggestions made in therapy. I'm referring particularly to repressed memories and false memories. As part of my reading, I've been both outraged and greatly saddened by the very poor outcomes of many people who sought help and were convinced they had received abuse that never occurred. Also, for those who were abused and whose credibility was undermined by the controversy surrounding this area. I'm able to expand on this area should you want, but rather hear your impressions, which continue to be both insightful and interesting. All the best and keep up the good work, Tom. And as I reply to Tom, I've been trying to chase down a particular author who is an expert in the whole issue of false memory syndrome. And she had initially said that she would be willing to be a guest on the show. However, she's not responded to my follow-up emails. I don't have a phone number for her. I'm going to keep trying because I think she'd be particularly first-rate. I also want to mention that I heard from Mo, our listener in Baghdad. I hadn't heard from him in some time, so I sent him an email the other day asking if he's okay. And I'm happy to report that he and his family are okay. Here's a snippet from his email. He writes, The violence is spreading like crazy. Now it's become hard to travel or even move inside many of Baghdad's danger zones. I wanted so much to go to Najaf City this year, but wasn't able for various reasons, including the increase of the organized and random killing almost everywhere. Now I have a friend who lives on the other side of Baghdad, whose brother had been killed recently in the sectarian violence. I couldn't go to the funeral and memorial service because of the curfews imposed by our government at the time and the violence that rendered the roads so dangerous afterwards. I do wish one day I can get out of here and have a normal life where I can leave home at night and go out to places where there are people without having to worry about a maniac who might come and blow us up. So, listeners, I know you will join me in wishing for his continued safety and an end to the conflict there. And I think that better wrap it up for our email today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. Alternatively, you're encouraged to leave voice messages or lovely transitions on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that at the Shrink Wrap Radio website. You know, my biggest challenge at this point is not producing these shows, but it's growing the audience. So please help me by letting potentially interested friends, family, teachers, therapists, and colleagues know about Shrink Wrap Radio. If each of you can recruit one more listener, the audience will double. Now, thanks again to our guest, Dr. James Pawelski, for the interview. And my next two shows are going to be something different. I've already conducted both interviews one morning earlier this week. You've heard of the movie Dances with Wolves? Well, I'm referring to that morning as Dances with Millionaires, inasmuch as both interviews are with very wealthy people and our focus is on the psychology of money. So my next show will be with Randy Gage, author of Why You're Dumb, Sick, and Broke, and How to Get Smart, Healthy, and Rich. Now, that's his title, not mine. You might want to catch this one. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.